We're back with today's Please Explain. Look at all of these deadly viruses that suddenly are in the news. My guest is Dr. Ian Lipkin, John Snow Professor of Epidemiology and Director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health and College of Physicians and Surgeons. Our number, 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. This isn't the first outbreak of Ebola, but it's the worst. And it seems to come in spurts. Is there a seasonal aspect to it?
There isn't a seasonal aspect to it, but you're correct in saying that it is the most, it's the worst outbreak that we've had. And in part, this reflects the fact that it's begun to infect people in urban areas.
Let's take a call. John from Huntington, Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, good afternoon. I would like to know if the strain of the Ebola virus mutates from one outbreak to the next, and if this is a new strain that has different, you know, properties than previous outbreaks.
Has it been pretty much consistent, or have we seen various strains?
So the question is whether or not this virus is different. It's evolved. It has different properties.
Mm-hmm.
So
we've seen with HIV.
Yes, that's as we've seen with HIV and flu and other viruses. So yes, this is a different strain. It has some different characteristics, but there's nothing to suggest that it is more aggressive or less aggressive, or more transmissible than other Ebola viruses.
Another listener wonders if someone who has survived Ebola becomes a carrier.
So this is an interesting question, and unfortunately I can't give you a very precise answer. But we do know that after people's symptoms resolve, they can remain infectious for some period of time, and this is one of the reasons why we continue to screen them using sensitive methods for detection of the virus after they're declared free of disease. And there are a number of bodily secretions that tend to persist as being infected, and the one that's the longest and go out for even as far as 2 to 3 months is semen. So it's possible that this could be a sexually transmitted disease, although that's not the most common mechanism for transmission.
Another listener wonders why there isn't more being done to contain the disease in terms of air travel. What would we do? We couldn't check every person who – I mean, we do – check them pretty thoroughly these days, but we couldn't check them for whether they were infected with something, incubating MERS or SARS or Ebola.
Well, in 2003 and in subsequent concerns relative to aerosol or droplet-transmitted diseases like influenza or SARS, we did see a lot of screening at international airports as people would move through airports that were thermal scanners. The problem, of course, is that someone can be relatively healthy at the time they get on a plane, and 14, 16 hours later, they can be very ill. So you would not be able to exclude them as being infected, even if they appeared at the airport in a fairly normal state. What we are doing, however, at the back end, when people arrive in the United States, if they're coming from an area where there's a potential for exposure, they're given cards and information that tells them to be in contact with local health officials in the event that somebody becomes ill.
Now, viruses, there are different kinds of viruses, aren't there? There are some that are singular, and then there are the kinds like the flu or, some of these other ones that are a bunch of different things that all work together.
Well,
misunderstood?
No, you've not misunderstood, but you've actually raised three important points, and I'm not sure we have time to get to them all. So one of the problems, of course, is
be succinct.
So sometimes it's not the virus itself that's the major problem. It's a bacterial superinfection which follows it. So this is a very common problem.
So people often wind
flu,
up with pneumonia, for
with
example.
Flu. So, for example, you can recover from flu, and then a week or two later you wind up having being treated with antibiotics because you have a bacterial pneumonia. That's not really the case with Ebola. Ebola is enough to do the job all by itself. The other thing is that although we like to talk about a virus as a virus, the fact is it's a swarm of a series of different genetic sequences, all with different sorts of properties. And they can adapt and move into different structures and cause different types of disease. So, yes, viruses are very complicated, very elegant creatures.
Is the same true for MERS and SARS?
That is true, yes. So with SARS, there was a there was a profound change in the genome of that virus as it moved from Guangzhou up to Beijing. And then it became capable of very rapid, very efficient human-to-human spread.
I remember when we first started hearing about HIV/AIDS, some people said that it probably had been around a lot longer and people probably had been infected with it for many years before we became aware of it, but it was only when a lot of people suddenly came down with it. Would that be true with these as well? So, I mean, why do we suddenly hear that we have this MERS thing that we have to be concerned about?
So with MERS, we know that camels were infected with a virus that's either very similar to the one we have or sufficiently similar so that they make antibodies that bind to it back as far as 1991. We don't have any samples that go back further than that. And we can't be certain that it was the same virus because we haven't been able to sequence it. On the other hand, with HIV, we've been able to find evidence of infection going back into the 1940s. And it didn't really come to the fore, really, until the virus was efficiently introduced into people through inoculations and the sexual revolution and travel and all the other things that opened it up and moved it worldwide.
In the case of Africa, Ebola has traveled to Nigeria through air travel. SARS and MERS both spread rapidly due to infected people traveling. I guess the alternative is to just tell people they can't travel anymore?
Oh, yes. That's going to work just fine. The fact is that even if we were to try to say no humans can move, animals move. And influenza is an example. Birds fly all over the world. They migrate, you know, twice annually. We have the same problem with bats. So there is no way to restrict infectious diseases.
Barry from Long Island, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, how are you? I have a question. I was watching on CNN last week when they brought that doctor from West Africa.
Oh, have they found that Malaysian plane yet? Were watching CNN. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. They were bringing him to Atlanta, Georgia for treatment, and they made a very big point of saying this was the first time a patient with Ebola or the Ebola virus was being brought to this hemisphere, which seemed to me to be catastrophically foolish to bring somebody here if it's never been here and expose hundreds of millions of people in this hemisphere to a possible Ebola outbreak, and you're giving that virus an opportunity it never would have had.
What's your response? You said earlier that Ebola doesn't spread all that easily, although we're seeing it spread.
I appreciate the caller's concern because this is something that's my mailbox is filled with similar sorts of comments, and I appreciate your concern. But I will say the following. Number one, the individual who was flown here was flown here in containment. He was in containment as he moved from the airport to Emory Hospital. At Emory Hospital, he was placed in what's called a negative pressure isolation room, which prevents anything from going in or going out. And the people who work there, many of them, are former members of the Centers for Disease Control, and the Centers for Disease Control is right up the road. There is no safer place to do such treatment than there. And the alternative was that we would have left these people who are our citizens to die. And that's just not something that we can accept either.
Can't they be treated in Africa? American doctors go and if the doctors in Africa aren't sophisticated enough? I'm sure there are many sophisticated African doctors.
This is very complicated.
And then there are Doctors Without Borders there.
Yes, but this is very complicated for two reasons. One, the mainstay of the therapy at this point is supportive. We have to be able to give people intravenous fluids. We have to ensure that they can, you know, they can oxygenate their blood. We have to monitor their chemistries. It's very difficult to do these things in a developing world country. So it's much easier to do that at Emory, and we believe we can do it safely. Now, the other thing, of course, is, you know, there's a lot of discussion about the drugs that were used, the secret sauce, right, the serum. There were two sera that were used. One was a serum from a boy who'd recovered from Ebola. This is a classic approach that we use.
It's called ZMAP?
Well, no, not even the ZMAP. This was what we call convalescent serum. So after you've recovered from infection, you can detect antibodies. You can give those antibodies. the original, you know, sort of concept of diphtheria antitoxin that was developed by von Behring, goes all the way back to the late 1890s, is an example of the efficacy of that sort of an approach. The second one is a series of antibodies called monoclonal antibodies that target and bind to specific regions of the virus and have the ability to prevent it from entering cells and causing disease. So we don't have enough of that material to use elsewhere, and there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not it's ethical to withhold that treatment. But given that experimental, we don't know necessarily that it's going to do more good than harm. And on the other hand, we could also be criticized for testing this material on people who aren't really capable of making an adequate judgment as to whether or not it's something they want to do. So it's sort of damned if you do, if you're damned if you don't. But these two individuals were capable of saying, yes, we want this experimental treatment. Their employers wanted this experimental treatment, and it was a safe and effective thing to do.
There's a story in today's New York Times about a hospital in Sierra Leone that patients have stopped coming to because so many people, including doctors and nurses, have died there. Can a building become infected?
Well, a building can't become infected, but you can have virus that can persist on walls, but you can decontaminate these things with laundry and burning and autoclaving and so forth. The major problem there is just that people have a great deal of difficulty separating cause and effect. They just look at an association. So as individuals will go into a specific area and find that nobody comes back, the assumption is that they died, they contracted the illness there, when in fact they brought the illness to them. So my friends in Hong Kong, for example, who are always the first to detect these agents that are circulating in South Asia, say, it doesn't originate in Hong Kong. We're just the first people to pick it up.
Now, most of the people who die tend to be young or old. Is this a matter of immune systems? Are the people who survive people with stronger immune systems?
It's possible that that's the case. I don't think we really know enough about that at this point. We know this, that we have a fatality rate with infection, which is approximately 60%. In other Ebola outbreaks, it's been as high as 90%. So this is one of the factors that complicates our ability to figure out whether or not these people had a bona fide response to this antibody cocktail that was used. We don't know if they would have survived without that cocktail. So that really requires what we call controlled clinical trials.
In this case, it's also killed health workers. Does that make it more difficult to get people to deal with it?
Yes, and it is this. We had this problem with MERS. We had this problem with SARS. Heroic individuals, not only the public health people who are out there doing the track tracing and figuring out who's at risk for disease, but the nurses and doctors who take care of these people.
What do you have to do to prevent yourself from becoming infected yourself?
Well, one of the things that we would like to do with the vaccines, once we begin to test them and are sure that they're not going to cause disease in their own right, is to vaccinate first responders, people who are at risk. And we've done this in the past when we've thought about other potential biothreat agents like anthrax. This could be done in the system too. Now, there are a number of other infectious agents that are less common in parlance, and we do have vaccines for those.
What do you think will contain and extinguish this outbreak? What steps should be taken?
It's going to be a tincture of common sense. I mean, we're going to have to find some way to prevail in the culture there and find ways to, you know, get people to actually isolate themselves and to make certain that they don't come into contact, despite the fact that it's going to be very difficult not to take care of their loved ones or to say goodbye to them in the ways that they typically do.
Because family members are the most vulnerable here.
Yes, because they're the ones who are most likely to come into contact with tissues and fluids that have high concentrations of virus.
So you're saying education is a key factor.
Education.
Dr. W. Ian Lipkin, John Snow Professor of Epidemiology and Director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health and College of Physicians and Surgeons, has been our guest on today's Please Explain. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure.